there's an artist who knows that brevity is the soul of wit, it's Archie Scott Gober, or Scotty, as he's known to friends. His art usually looks like a sign you'd see over a shop door or someplace like that. And it's typically a joke where the humor comes from a subtle shift, like removing or altering a letter or two from a recognizable word in a recognizable font. One of his most recent signs just says Twitter minus that last T-E-R. So all that's left is the twit. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And Scotty is here in the studio with me now. Hi, Scotty.
Good morning.
You've got an upcoming residency at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Tell me about it.
The Nelson has partnered with Charlotte Street Foundation in celebration of their 20th year anniversary, titled Every Street is Charlotte Street. And I was an award winner of the Charlotte Street Award in 1998, the second year that they were given. And so Charlotte Street is partnering with many organizations, art organizations in Kansas City, for sort of a year-long celebration of their 20th anniversary. And the Nelson being gracious enough and pleased to partner with Charlotte Street to host this artist-in-residence program.
So what will you do as the artist-in-residence there? I mean, I'm not familiar with that museum having people in that role on the regular.
Well, I think, yeah, it's, you know, maybe a new thing, and I don't know that it is a new thing, but I will be down in the Ford Learning Center. I'll have one of the classrooms down there, and I will be painting my little signs and goofing off, pretty much. I mean, they've given me sort of the run of certain areas in the museum, and I will be making pieces that will then be placed in art areas and non-art areas throughout, say, the European and American art, contemporary art sections of the museum.
So you'll get to place your signs within those other gallery spaces?
Yes, ma'am.
So how... I imagine you having a really good time with that.
Well, I am, and I'm very excited about it. The Nelson has been very excited, very welcoming to me, very generous with their time. I've spent time with four separate curators that were just amazing and got me really excited about the whole thing because... as an artist, you usually have these rather large ideas about what you'd like to do. And then as the deadline, so to speak, gets closer and closer, you edit and simplify. And I'm still in that process and really only about a week out from starting this.
What do you think are some opportunities of a museum setting for someone who does the kind of work you do? I mean, I'm thinking about just signage plays a pretty specific role in museums and usually looks this like branded kind of way. Is that something you're going to be playing with?
Yeah. Pardon me. I will be. Long pause.
That was,
that was horrible,
a long pause.
Wasn't it? My gosh.
It's okay. You're self-referential, not just as an artist, but also as an interview subject.
Well, and the interesting thing about approaching the Nelson, and I don't know that I'm going to be dealing, say, specifically with certain artworks or the collection as a whole. I like to think that what I'm going to do could then be done in really any museum, the Museum of Modern Art or whatever, but more general ideas or suggesting things, which I so often do. I don't supply answers. I basically ask questions generally.
What are some of the questions that are running through your mind as you think about that setting and your residency?
Well, ideas, approaching it from as an artist and knowing how artists live and try to make it in the world, sort of wondering what the context of that was when, say, Van Gogh was painting or and ideas of patronage and how patronage shapes art. When did a landscape become a viable, marketable item? You know, questions like that.
When your style of work is so driven by text, are there words or phrases that you're already kind of kicking around?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean,
Can you tell us about some of them, or does that kill the magic for you?
Well, not everyone in the world is listening, so I'm sure I can share this. You know, I've got one that just says no fakes, but it's spelled K-N-O-W.
Ah.
Ha-ha, clever, huh?
Yeah, but what does it mean to you?
Well, it means know your fakes or question what's real.
That's also...
And then in a museum collection, I mean, there are reports that, you know, a certain percentage of artworks in a museum quite possibly are fake, so...
When you say no fakes or no fakes, K-N-O-W or N-O, either way, I just politically right now...
Well, fake's a big word right
fake
now.
Fake is a big word.
Sure.
And a lot of your work does sort of play with political jargon. I mean, you have another recent sign that's conceal and carry on in that keep calm and carry on font that is used on T-shirts and all sorts of affirming paraphernalia.
Yes.
How do you think that those kinds of political references, even though it's not totally clear, like exactly what you're trying to say about politics, how do you think that's going to go over in a public setting like a museum?
Well, hopefully famously. But that aside, I mean, my biggest goal generally when I make something is to not pick a side.
How do you not pick a side? I mean, what is your
technique?
Well, it's
difficult. It's difficult. I think words mean different things to different people along your political ideology. And so you can say certain things that work for both sides that don't. I mean, it's very easy to make a sign that says, you know, you're stupid or something, but it's much harder to make a sign that doesn't tell you you're stupid, but you might think that it's saying that.
There's a sign you made, I mean, right after the foreclosure crisis.
Right.
That is something that has always stuck with me. It's just the word broker, which can refer to someone in real estate. But the way that you wrote it, the R looks tacked on in,
right,
in a different font and with a different background. And so it makes you think about broke versus broker.
Right.
And
being penniless.
In the middle of that crisis where people's entire financial solvency was upended by real estate, just the font of one letter in that one word sent a sort of chilling message.
Yeah, a completely different message. And I mean, and it's sort of broken English. You wouldn't say, I don't know what you could say, I'm broker today than I was yesterday, or, you know, but it, and these aren't like heavy ideas. They just kind of, my love of letter forms and love of the ambiguity of language, allows me to make something successful, and that's kind of my stock in trade.
When did you kind of stumble on what, I don't know, you could call your trademark style? There's a visual, your style is recognizable just to the eye if people have seen your work, but also, I don't want to say formula because that implies that you are doing something cookie cutter, but you do have a lens, a way of approaching language and type and putting those things together.
Sure. As an artist, you worry about the cookie cutter thing. And I mean, anyone who knows me knows I am a consummate worrier. You see artists make paintings and you think, well, that looks a lot like most of your paintings, but that's how we operate. We find an interest in a niche, and we explore it as far as we can. And my biggest fear is that I'll have nothing to say one of these times.
Well, but I'm curious where this kind of approach came from. Do you remember the first time it just clicked?
I actually ceased making art for about 5 years.
When?
Prior to 2001, and probably in conjunction with when I won the Charlotte Street Award. I wasn't set up for it. I was getting married. We were buying a house. We were, there were other things. It wasn't fitting into my life at that point. And then September 11th happened, and the first piece, when I got back to it, the first piece I made was just text. And that, it's been that way pretty much since.
What did that first piece say?
Well, it was comparing terrorists to financial terrorists, in a sense. Osama bin Laden, Arthur Anderson. It was these comparisons between evildoers and wrongdoers.
So you had, lists of words kind of juxtaposed against one another?
Exactly.
Do you have a relationship with signage that goes back, like, in your life?
Well, I do. I have memories of my father was a bread delivery man, and he would have to make signs, and he would sit in the basement and with these giant stinky markers and make these signs for bread for sale. Some of the first art I ever made was graphics and words. I painted signs in high school.
What kind of signs did you paint in high school?
Well, one was for an auto body shop. I would just do that. I worked for a sign painter for a very short, maybe just over a summer one time, and just really became infatuated with that form of communication.
The auto body shop is sort of a long way from the museum, and I'm curious I'm curious about the highbrow, lowbrow thing going on here.
Well, I want to bring a little bit of lowbrow into it, because museums are seen as highbrow type places, but they are for everyone. There is something, I think, for everyone to gain from that experience of looking at things and questioning things and wondering, even in historical context, what people were going through.
That might not have been as fancy as the surroundings that their paintings are currently in would make you think.
Exactly,
about.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a portrait and you go, okay, well, when these were presented, there were probably 30 of them on the wall. And how did you get noticed as a portrait painter? That's how people made money. How do you get noticed? Well, you use really bright colors. Or you do fabric better than anyone, or you do eyes better than anyone, and it was where you were hanging on the wall. Were you at eye level? Were you, because they used to stack paintings to the ceiling pretty much. They would hang them everywhere. So
when you think about your time doing signs for places like auto body shops, I mean, the easy sort of knee-jerk assumption that is lowbrow also might be kind of flawed. And I'm curious about your idea of, the skill of sign making and the trade arts.
As a craft or something?
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting. Within the Nelson Collection, they have an amazing decorative arts collection that they've done a wonderful job of laying in with paintings and everything that was going on at that time, and those were craftspeople essentially. And when did they become known as artists? When did things that were produced like that, they were just made by people that maybe no one knew?
Scotty, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Gina.
Scotty is known by the alias Archie Scott Gober, and he's the artist in residence at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art from August 14th to August 27th. Up next, Shakespeare's Macbeth downsized to just 3 performers. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now I'm here with Kyle Hatley, a recognizable name to Kansas City theater goers. He used to be one of the visionaries at the KC Rep, but While he was there, he had lots of side projects, staging his own creations in experimental venues that were kind of off the beaten path. He's really professionalized experimental theater in Kansas City and drummed up a pretty wide audience for it. Well, Kyle moved to Chicago, but he hasn't lost touch with the theater scene here. He's back with a version of Macbeth that promises to be lean, athletic, and intimate as a whisper. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm so good. It's good to be back.
How long have you been in Chicago?
Almost 3 years. Next week, I think, exactly what is how long I've been away, yeah.
And Macbeth has called you back?
It has, yes.
Why reinvent Macbeth?
Well, you know, I think it all sort of started about 13 months ago. I'd been sort of thinking about doing something new and diving back in. I'd been doing more acting than I had directing or writing, and I wanted to get back into that side of it. So, I think I was a little outraged by the campaign.
The presidential campaign.
And I didn't know where to put it. So I was very loud about it on social media, and it just didn't seem to go anywhere. It just felt like an empty way to sort of,
as though you were screaming into a void.
Exactly. So I think I think what most artists do in that moment, is turn to the page or turn to another source or turn to whatever it is that can extract what I'm angry about, or maybe even examine why I'm angry. And if I even have the right to be. It just felt like this play was, it just kept coming to my mind. Every crazy thing, every notification on my phone from a news source that would teach all of us, you know, every 13 hours, something outrageous,
I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. Take us back to English 101.
Sure.
For people who perhaps have not read Macbeth, and I'm going to confess something. I have not read Macbeth. I've read a lot of Shakespeare plays, but not that one. So tell me, the synopsis of this Shakespeare play and then some of the themes, and then we'll go from there.
Absolutely. So this play, there's this King Duncan, and they are at war with the Norwegians. And one of their greatest sort of men of the battle, one of their greatest thanes, is Macbeth, and another guy named Banquo. And they're coming home from this victorious battle that they somehow impossibly managed to win, against all odds. And they come across these three supernatural beings who appear out of nowhere, and present a prophecy to them, to both of them. To Macbeth, they say that you are going to be king. To Banquo, they say you will not be king, but your children will be king. And then what happens next is Macbeth's own his own ambition begins to take over, and he begins to see further down than just being thane. He's been told that he's going to be the Thane of Cawdor, and then next he will be king. And so, but at the time, he's just Thane of Glamis. And then shortly thereafter, hearing that news, these witches disappear into thin air, and then a messenger arrives and says, "Hey, Macbeth, you're going to be Thane of Cawdor." And he says,
"What is a thane?"
Essentially, like a ruling factor or a ruling position.
Gotcha.
Over territory, and
so it's like not as good as king.
Correct. But you almost have to be that before you become king, okay. Et cetera. And they are all kinsmen of Duncan the king. So essentially, what happens next is. He questions the situation, these supernatural beings, they've told me this thing, and then it happened in a way, the first step of what they promised happened. I am now Thane. What must I do to become king? And then these thoughts start coming into his head without his control, without filter, which I think is his own personal ambition, and he begins to wonder how he can become king next. And so that must mean that he has to assassinate the king, in order to become king. And so he writes a letter home to his wife before he arrives back from this war. And his wife essentially aids him in this, in trying to become king, and they basically come up with a plan, to make this happen quicker.
So and trying to speed along fate.
Correct. Yes, exactly. Correct. Not knowing exactly if it's something that if he should wait on chance or if he should take that chance himself. Unsure of how it's all going to unfold because of the strangeness of these three visitors and their message for them. And then what happens next is he murders King Duncan. He assumes the crown because King Duncan's sons flee. They as soon as this happens, they fear their own lives, fear for their own lives, and they flee. And in doing this, people, the other thanes, the other sort of leaders of this land begin to question. There's a sort of a division that begins to happen. Some of them are right there next to Macbeth, and some of them begin to sort of remove themselves from the equation and put themselves in exile to figure out what to do in terms of like, is this guy guilty of killing our king? And if so, that's treason. And murder and treason, and then we must remove him and take the throne back. And so as he continues down this road, Macbeth is beginning to see that there are other sort of forces in his way.
You know, I have read Julius Caesar, which is another Shakespeare play, and it seems like really similar kinds of themes to that. Mm-hmm. From the outside, I mean, it sounds like this question of is your fate really in your own hands? And if so, that can sound like such a positive, encouraging, like hopeful, optimistic idea, but it can also propel people to commit acts of violence, to, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think the closer you get to something you want, the harder you go about getting it. And you might even step outside the bounds of reason or the bounds of rationality to do so. Specifically, if you're given to a more brutal sort of ambition within yourself.
Listening to you talk about Macbeth, you are clearly so passionate about this play. And you've whittled it down to just three performers, and as I understand it, one of them is not acting. It's a musical performer.
That's correct. I'm playing. There are three players that enter the space. These strange, mysterious players, and they appear out of nowhere, and they begin to tell us the story. And it's Natalie Licardello plays player number two. I play player number one, and we play all of the different roles. So we split up all of the speaking roles and perform them all, while Sean Hogue plays player number three, and he scores the whole thing live while also calling lights, sound, and effects.
But why do it this way?
I think it was a personal challenge to see if I could. Most of the projects that I do, specifically if they're classic adaptations of classics or retellings of classics, I tend to go big and then as big as I can. Some of these casts that we've done with Titus Andronicus or Death of Cupid or even Master of the Universe are, you know, from eight people.
There was
to 20
one where you
people.
Made a beach. I mean, you put that was sand Death of all over
yeah.
the place.
And that had about 26 people in that one. It was just a power of numbers situation. And I think there are some stories that can really sort of work in that way. And I wanted to see the sort of inversion of that. I wanted to see if there was another way to go about that. Because to me, it felt like if we were going to tell this story about which feels so incredibly, about right now, that I wanted to make it more personal. And I learned a lot about how to do that while performing an Iliad at Kansas City Repertory Theater in 2015. And sort of that one, that's kind of a one man show, but really actually is sort of there are two people up there. It was the poet, which is the role I played, and then the muse, which is the role that Ray Castry played. And he performed everything live on stage. And so there's this duality between the two of them, and together, they could sort of take something very, very big and maintain its immenseness through something through the impact of one storyteller and the muse that sort of encourages him along, etc. And so that kind of inspired me to go about trying it this way. And I've worked with Natalie and Sean on almost every project I've ever done. And so it felt like with these three, we could figure it out together. With the three of us, we could sort of figure the story out in a leaner way so that there is no intermission. It's a 90-minute adaptation. And while we do use Shakespeare's language, we have crafted sort of stage directions in a way that we sort of speak to each other or narrate to each other to sort of help move the scene along or to help illustrate something that we can't do with more than three people, et cetera, which I think then puts a lot into the minds and thoughts of our viewers, of our audience, and gives them a role to play in terms of using their imagination. And this play beckons for your imagination to start working pretty hard, whether you do it with three people or with 20, et cetera. So I just wanted to kind of exaggerate that and give the audience an opportunity to kind of work with us on that and see the things that we're seeing without having to show them or build them in a way. But I think it also personalizes everything.
Can you give an example of something that is personalized in this play by just the spareness of it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there are two things that sort of, as we were developing this adaptation, workshop by workshop, we started to discover early on that there were sort of a second play being told simultaneously with the story of Macbeth. So these three players show up and they begin to tell this story. And what you're also witnessing is the story of these three players and how they tell it and what's happening to them as it's being told. So we coordinate, Natalie and I will coordinate with Sean Hoag while we're telling something. Like if we need a sound or a light or something like that, we look at him and we build it right in front of the audience, right? And so that's all kind of fun and neat as you're beginning to watch it, but then it begins to sort of decay. And the person, I think that where we're trying to sort of drive the sort of that spike of a personal perspective is in what happens to these players as that begins to decay, as their connections begin to break down, as player one, who plays the certain series of tracks of roles that are mostly the murderers in the play or the people of force in the play, whereas Natalie, player two, plays the people who have been acted upon, like Banquo and Lady Macduff, etc. And so the way these roles are assigned and carved out sort of begin to create a simultaneous narrative for player one and player two, and they're beginning to deepens the relationship between the characters and their standoffs, so to speak. Like Natalie plays Banquo and I play Macbeth, but she also plays Lady Macbeth, and she also plays Lady Macduff, and I play Macduff. So like there are all these different scenarios in which player one and player two are having to be intimate in different ways, as a friend, as a colleague, as a wife and husband, as a murderer and a murderee, if that's a word.
I mean, are you asking people to kind of question how similar these different kinds of relationships are?
Yes, as a matter of fact, and how we trust relationships and how we trust truth from people we think we know. The way we sort of bend from one character into another, kind of like going from, for instance, there's a moment where Natalie plays Lady Macduff, and she tells this story. That's to me that section of the play that Lady Macduff is. Sorry, forgive me. Macduff is one of the protagonists of the play who later comes in and defeats Macbeth at the end. And he's sort of the warmer, lighter, the good man of the story, other than Banquo. But he comes back in and he defeats Macbeth. But one of the things that sort of gives him the courage to do so, or gives him the ignition to do so, I suppose, is that his wife and children are savagely murdered by Macbeth in order to sort of, in an effort to sort of remove Macduff from the equation entirely as another force that might stop Macbeth. And so there's a moment where Natalie gets done.
So he just like reaches this like, I don't care, you took everything.
You took everything and I'm going to take you. You know, I mean, it's that Greek sort of revenge feeling, you know. But there's a moment where Natalie, as Lady Macduff, tells this story about how she and her children were murdered. And as soon as that moment is over, my character, player one, starts another scene, not giving her a single moment to move forward. And so what she has to carry from that previous scene into the next informs that next scene. Completely different scenario, completely different character. And that's how we've sort of arranged this adaptation, is to create these two sort of arcs for player one and player two that are that follow the arcs of these other, or the arcs of the arc of the story itself, but kind of splay and go off in different directions to sort of deepen its meaning as we do so.
You know, we are about the same age, and I don't meet a lot of people in our age group who are as passionate as you are about like Shakespeare and the Greek classics. And I'm curious about your history with that stuff.
Yeah, I can't even I think I've just always responded to the language when it comes to classic works and the kind of bigness of their themes. Like there's no messing around. Like that, you know exactly what we're talking about. You know exactly what the theme is. You know exactly what these characters are and exactly what they're doing.
It's bold, like meaning of life type stuff.
It is. It's huge and it's immense, and I love that. But what's great about what I love working with in the classics is taking that huge. These enormous ideas and these enormous images and these big personalities, and then starting to kind of chip away and whittle them down to like human beings that look and talk like you and me, and then hopefully and then also like trying to find ways where we can sort of balloon them back up when we need to, so that we can remind ourselves of the bigness of what we're talking about and dealing with. And so I think their flexibility or their malleability, the malleability of how you can tell stories that are, you know, older than anyone we know and older than almost time itself, and you know, it just feels like something that we've. I don't know. It feels like when we work with classics, we're working with yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Like there's a reason we're still telling them, because we need to hear them. But they're also just so much a part of our lives, of our culture, of the way we sort of identify with ourselves. I think they're still personal to us. You know what I mean? Like I can say Macbeth is a bad guy, but there are parts of him that I can see in anybody I know, including myself.
What do you see in yourself that reminds you of Macbeth?
Well, I think he deals with, I don't know why this is, but I have a naturally guilty conscience.
Even if you haven't done anything?
Even if I haven't done anything. We joke around and say that's my Catholic upbringing, but I don't know what it is. I don't like stepping on people's toes, so to speak. But maybe that has something to do with why I work in such a collaborative art form, too, is because it trains you to be sure not to do that, but also to be kind when you do and to, you know, find ways to move forward when you do. But, I mean, I think there's something about Macbeth that I can identify with, not the evil, ugly, hateful, horrible, ambitious stuff.
Murderer.
Yeah, none of that. I mean, I can barely hold it. I can't even look at a gun. I'm terrified of any instrument that can kill a human being. But I think I can understand how a good person can go bad. I'd be lying to myself if I didn't say that any of us were. I mean, I'm impervious to that. I'm not impervious to that. I'm like, I think any human being, good nature or bad nature to begin with, I think has the capacity to sort of break bad, so to speak.
I had wondered, I mean, you seem from the outside to be a pretty ambitious person. And I wondered if maybe the ambition of Macbeth was something that you could relate to.
I could see how that might look like that. I think all artists have to have some kind of ambition in them. I wouldn't hurt or kill or step on anybody to, you know, to achieve whatever my goals were, because I feel like that's not the game. I think you're not playing the game of life or the game of being an artist or the game of being a human being if you're having to push other people out of the way to do so. Now, I think you will come across adversaries, but I mean, I think how you deal with those adversaries have a lot to say about your character. And I think the difference between, I would say a very clear difference between Macbeth and I would be, I'm not going to kill them. I'm not going to push them aside. I'm going to find another way around, my own way to do something. And you know, as I've learned, though, I think when I was here in Kansas City, I used to try to squeeze every project I could, or any project I could, in between any project I had, because that's what made me feel sort of like I was actively participating in a conversation that felt dire and necessary from the standpoint of an artist at work. However, I think I've learned, especially after my wife and I got married and moved to Chicago, and just kind of relaxed a little bit and started like letting life come to me instead of trying to chase it. And that's really, I think, that's informed a lot personally and professionally. I think I have more time now to develop something like this than I did before. Like, it's been 13 months in the making since I first sat down and started, you know, conceiving this adaptation, and I would have never worked on something for that long because I couldn't have. There's no way I would have been able to give it that much attention.
So in Chicago, you've been more an actor than a director, mm-hmm. you mentioned.
That's correct. Yeah, I've been it's sort of my first love and the one I can always sort of go back to. But I think that's how Chicago might have remembered me when I was there in my early 20s. I was more of an actor then as well. And I met Eric Rosen there and started assisting him as a director and assisting other directors in town. And that's where I sort of began my development and my interest as a director from that point on. And that's frankly the thing I love directing more than anything else. but being in something that I'm directing is thrilling. I'm glad it's a small cast because I don't think it would be as manageable otherwise.
When you thought about this idea of playing with Macbeth and playing with it in the context of just today's politics, was it immediate that you thought, I need to go back to Kansas City to do this?
Yeah, my first thought was, yeah, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm wearing three hats in this. It's my own adaptation that I've been developing with Sean and Natalie, and also that, you know, I wanted to play Player One for a few reasons. One, to be inside it, to understand it as an actor, really helps me clear it up as a writer. Now the direction part of it, I think, I don't know. That's the part that I'm sort of really involved in right now, and it's actually easier than I thought it would be. On other projects, it wouldn't be. But the fear that I had, or the concern rather that I had about wearing those three hats at the same time, I wanted to go somewhere where I felt at home. I wanted to go somewhere where I felt like I could get the artistic support and a support of the community to develop this first draft.
Kyle Hatley, enjoy your time in Kansas City, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Tragedy of Macbeth is at the Living Room in the Crossroads from August 9th to September 3rd. I'm Gina Kaufman. It's time for a short break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll catch up with singer Julia Hale of The Buzz and Hilux. Stay tuned. Kansas City first met Julia Hale when she was a young conservatory grad singing covers of R&B classics with the Goodfoot at sweaty dance parties all over town. But after that, Julia took a hiatus from the Kansas City stage, and it's safe to say that her singing career is back in full swing. She's got two bands, The Buzz and Hilux. Here's a taste of a dancey little Hilux tune.
All I got to say is that I love you each and every day.
Julia's performing as part of Generationless in KC's Stockyard Sounds next weekend, and we're going to catch up with her now. Hi, Julia.
Good morning.
How would you distinguish the sound of what you do in Hilux with, you know, your other outfits, from The Buzz, which is current, to your previous work with The Goodfoot?
Well, I really am in love with Hilux because the players are so diverse. We have a couple of the original Goodfooters. Tim Braun is playing guitar. Kian Byrne, the drummer for the Elders, is drumming with us, and he has a big reggae background. And our trumpet player from Goodfoot, Nick Howell, is actually playing keys, and he has a real, like, meters New Orleans sound on the keys, and we've got so many different sounds that we're able to mold into some kind of almost neo soul sounds. So I love it. There's so much going on.
I mentioned earlier that people really got to know you with the Goodfoot, and that band always seemed like it would be so much fun to be in, maybe just because you were performing songs that people know and love to dance to and kind of know well enough to feel comfortable dancing to.
Yes, which absolutely.
I think is a little rare in Kansas City. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn there.
No, that's an element that I loved being in that band. You know, I could take inventory of the audience when we'd get going and be like, oh, you know, there's a guy at the bar, this couple's on a date. You know, some people are just automatically ready to dance. But I love seeing that moment in the crowd when someone who was paying attention but not really out on the floor turns around and goes, oh, I love this song, and has to get out and start dancing. I love seeing that. I'm like, I gotcha, get out here. You can dance now. Yeah, feel free to. So it was always so much fun. People really loved to enjoy that band. It was great.
Was it, I don't know, the move from doing covers to venturing into work, like doing bands that do more original material, was that a big leap for you?
Huge, really. I think for a lot of my musical upbringing and career, I've been handed music or selected music and was able to kind of internalize the feelings that were already there. But now it's my own feelings. And I've never been great about, you know, I have never been great about finishing a body of work that is my own and throwing it out into the world. That's really hard. It's very personal. I mean, everybody goes through that. I'm always amazed at especially young songwriters who have these like deep emotional connections to things and are able to say, "Hey, world, this is what I'm feeling. I'm not as ready to do that." So it has been a challenge, but I think I'm getting better at it. And Hilux has helped me do that. I'm trying to write as much as possible.
I guess I'm wondering how you got into singing. I mean, we'll talk about some of the Hilux songs maybe that do share a more personal side of you, but what was singing about for you if it wasn't originally about that impulse to share something with the world in that sense?
Well, I guess from a very, very early age, it was something I felt good at. You know, it was I started singing young. I come from a very musical family. My mother has a beautiful voice. My aunt is an opera singer, and I was just always singing. And I thought, wow, this feels good, and the reaction I get when I'm singing from people is good. So maybe this is something I can really do.
When did you, are you from Kansas City?
I was actually born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but my mother is from Kansas City. So we moved to KC when I was about 6.
And then you attended the conservatory?
Yes. I went to St. Teresa's Academy, sang in as many choirs and did as many competitions as I could do there, and went on to study classical music at the conservatory. Yeah.
When you got involved with the Goodfoot, that was such a big deal locally. It really took off. Were you surprised by that a cover band would have the kind of, I don't know, magnetism for Kansas City's like really kind of hardcore like jazz and music fans?
Yeah.
Like people really treated your band with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of respect.
I was very surprised, and I remember seeing a small blurb in The Pitch, I believe it was, that simply said, like, do we need a break from rock and roll? Yes. Is Goodfoot what we needed? Yes. And I thought, wow, people were really ready for this. They were ready for to hear that kind of music live, and just like you said earlier, like really wanted to dance to it. You know, there was obviously a lot of amazing music in Kansas City, but we carved out something a little different.
You did take a little hiatus after that, and I'm wondering what that was about.
It's funny. It's like that hiatus kind of just, it wasn't meant to be a hiatus. It just kind of like happened. It was going from working so much with the Goodfoot to like nothing. I was like, oh, I have a Friday and Saturday night that I'm not singing for 4 hours. You know, it was something that just kind of happened that I just kind of like enjoyed, like leaned into. I wasn't trying to steal away, but I guess the universe told me I needed a little break, so I decided to listen.
With one of your newer songs, I Can't Let Go, I want to hear a little bit of that, because when you talked about sharing more from your life, is this something that shares from your life, or I'm not sure whether you wrote this song or not?
Well, Herman Mahari actually wrote the music and presented it to me to write lyrics to. And, you know, I think we both, the idea he had when he wrote it and what I got when I was listening to it was kind of the same. And when he told me, you know, this is kind of where the music goes for me, I thought, I'm kind of feeling the same way. So, of course, I drew on elements of my own life. And in the process of trying to get better about writing, I can draw from my own life. And then I look around and think, what have the people that I loved experienced? You know, what would they say in this type of song, you know, to someone? So I kind of pull from both sides.
Let's listen a little bit. This is I Can't Let Go.
Understand the truth. Every young
About blaming something on youth and thinking of youth as careless and selfish. Maturity is not a very common theme to explore in music, like especially pop music.
Yeah. I guess that's something I've tried to focus on in the last few years is where am I as a person? How am I developing? How have I developed from the time when I was young and kind of didn't take things into consideration or just kind of lived my life in a certain way? And I just try to take stock from time to time and reevaluate. And I think if I keep the practice up of doing that, then I will eventually get better and grow. That's kind of where that came from. And again, sitting down and making yourself think, okay, if I had to say something about this experience, what would it be? And growth is a part of that.
I love that it's like, if I had to say something. You know what I mean?
So
many people, I think, I don't know, it's like as though you have to do it.
Yeah.
Not so much that like you're naturally inclined to.
Yeah, if... you know, not that anyone's got a knife to my back saying you've got to get this out, but maybe I word it as such because I know I truly deep down need to. So it's like, okay, just get these feelings out and see how you feel afterwards.
You know, a year ago you talked with Hannah Copeland of the Ghost Notes podcast, and you said you were really struggling to balance your day job with your passion, which is obviously music. Is that still the case?
No, I quit that job.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I love getting that reaction when I tell people that I've moved on from that phase. Congratulations is a good feeling, and so much love to that time in my life and those people, but. Yeah, a certain responsibility was kind of hovering over my brain all the time, and I felt, okay, it's time to, it's affecting both sides. I feel like I can't express myself as much as I want to musically, and I when I'm on the job, I'm thinking about music. You know, I needed to make that separation, so I have done that, and I feel like I'm working a little better now.
What was the tipping point for you that you knew you could do it or had to do it?
Well, I, again, kind of looked at the past and how that job had, I had grown into a certain position and grown into the work I was doing. And at the time, musically, things lined up and then things weren't lining up anymore. And I had to pick a side.
When you get on stage, I would describe your persona as like quiet charisma. I mean, you don't ham it up in any way, shape, or form. Like,
no.
Not at all.
No.
But there is something really powerful about your presence on stage. And it might partly come from how little you appear to be actively doing to get our attention. Like, you don't need that in a way.
Yeah, well, part of me, and I actually got the chance to talk to some like young singers about this recently, is, you know, for as much as I had to get over like a certain nervousness getting on stage for so long, I had to tell myself, you know, people have other things going on in their lives. They might be here, but half of these people might not be thinking about what I'm doing. So I kind of take that out of it, like everyone's staring at me. So I just let go and kind of don't think about what's going on. I'm communicating through music.
This is a Hilux song that just recently came back from being mixed, and we're going out on that. Anything you want people to know about this song?
Well, this song was actually written by Kian Byrne, and I love it. I love the way it moves. I love the way it grooves. And it's gotten a great reaction from the crowds when we've played it. It's just another true expression of feeling and keeping those feelings basic and telling people truly how you feel. And I just think it's a great song.
Well, our time is up. Julia Hale, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Julia's got lots of shows coming up in August, including Jen Lesson Casey's Stockyard Sounds next Tuesday, August 8th, at Stockyard Brewing Company in the West Bottoms. Her band Hilux will also be at Minibar on August 18th. You can listen back to this conversation and our other artist interviews at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, though we aren't hearing it right now, but we usually do. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.